A unique introduction for a unique guest. Diane Brady is Executive Editorial Director at Fortune and the voice behind the influential CEO Daily newsletter. A veteran journalist with a global perspective, she's reported from boardrooms and war zones, always chasing clarity in a world flooded with noise. Known for her sharp insights, empathetic interviews, and rare ability to distill complexity into connection, Diane brings decades of perspective on power, policy, and purpose. Today, The Disruptors flips the script and puts the spotlight on the interviewer herself.
I've been really excited about this particular interview because I'm actually interviewing the interviewee.
The trauma that I'm feeling right now of being on the other side is beyond explanation, but I will see how I do.
You know, you as a journalist, and I have a plethora of questions, but I always merge it into things that are on the top of my mind. But, you know, you, looking back on your career, you've had some pivotal moments that, you know, shaped your approach to reporting. Kind of give me, in a minute or two, you know, the now, maybe,
the
and
now,
go, and go
what
backwards.
Made me, well, first I have to say I'm so pleased to be on The Disruptors versus The Disrupted because, you know, we are talking about the media business here. I became a journalist as a kid we'd moved around a lot and I was always the one sent into the neighborhood to find out, you know, to do the due diligence, you know, who has the color TV, who has a pool, what are their names. So curiosity is what drives me. I started a column when I was 15 in my local newspaper, the Burlington Post in Burlington, Ontario, and that was mainly to meet my favorite band, the Spoons, local band, and I did that for a couple of years, and really I've been a journalist ever since. I did a newspaper for all the high schools when I was in university and then went to McLean's and ended up going to Asia, which I think was pivotal for me to go work at the Wall Street Journal. So in every iteration, I think of myself, yes, as a storyteller, but much more as somebody who gets the gift to learn from people. Mm-hmm. And that's why I became a journalist, is the reporting part. The writing, the speaking, it's really to justify the license to find out what's going on.
And I applaud you for that, but now we're in a business of headlines.
Yeah.
And what often people affectionately
it's
call...
It's always been the business of headlines. You think it's that different?
That's a great challenging question. I say the answer is yes, but it's the power of that headline and the instantaneous nature of that headline through social media. It just feels like it impacts us a little more like an algorithm now than it does tomorrow's news.
Well, all the more reason to stand back. I mean, look, we are talking on a day where there have been multiple announcements from the White House about tariffs. And So you could, you know, markets up, markets down. It's what are we doing today? What are we doing tomorrow? I mean, you could spend your life just looking for rhetorical tidbits to fall off the back of the truck and constantly write headlines. Or you can take that, try to stand back and try to make sense of it. I'm not saying that we're pundits or soothsayers or we have a magic ball, but at a certain point, you have to stand back and start to just figure out what matters and bring intelligence to this and find out who are the people that bring intelligence. Sometimes it's by virtue of the position that you hold. You're influential. Sometimes it's the way you think. It's the rooms you get into. Or it's the voices that we're not hearing that are the ones we need to hear. So I don't get as ricocheted by this and that. I mean, of course, seismic things happen. You cover it. Mm-hmm. But this is a long game. You know, life is a long game. Business is a long game. If you're just constantly putting out a tsunami of stuff, I don't think
you're. And I think over the long haul, you lose credibility if people are listening to what you have to say. Because if you're always kind of tagging, you know, what I call clickbait, you know, so to speak.
Clickbait or you know, you cover it like sports. Again, it's being true also to the brand you're with. I mean, different places I've worked, it's a different focus. And so I don't have the hubris to think Diane Brady, everywhere I go, I cover things the same. I'm respectful to who is my audience. My customer is the audience. Why do they come to this brand? And what can I deliver to them that adds value so they come back? Nobody has to listen to me read me. I mean, you know, it's...
Of course.
Life's about
it's
choices.
It's a choices,
life's
right.
about choice, yeah.
And that's something I want to get back to, because as now we live in this digital media age, you know, not that I'm asking you to advertise for Fortune or not for Fortune, but, you know, now
buy,
it's getting...
Buy Fortune.
Yeah, exactly. Right now, it's on the newsstand. But if you start thinking about the differentiator of Fortune, you know, Bloomberg, all the rest of these news mediums, as we follow and mute towards the same types of news, you know, what's that nuance? What's the difference that makes Fortune a different magazine?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know what I mean, I've worked at Maclean's, the Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg, Business Week, Forbes. I mean, and where haven't I worked is probably a good question. And I'd say what differentiates Fortune that surprised me, actually, Bruce, was it has an incredible convening power with the Fortune 500, the Global 500. So if you think about the leaders of the world's largest companies, I had underestimated the degree to which Fortune is a trusted brand and almost like a village green for them to come and have conversations. So I think the fact that people assume Fortune wants to make people smarter, that they're not out to get you. I mean, yes, we hold, you know,
whatever. Responsible.
Yeah, right. Speak truth to power, but that convening power is something I've found to be very useful, that people know if they're talking to Fortune that it is, that we genuinely care and are curious about what they're doing, that we want to see the world through their eyes. And that we want to really, that they're a core part of our audience with founders, and again, I can't just say public companies, because a lot of the biggest companies now are private, but to really understand, to look at it through the lens of business leaders, I think is a great filtering conceit. And it's not just the content and the conversations, it's also the connections now. And so, as you know, we have dinners around the country in CEOs' homes. So there's the on-the-record Fortune. There's also the off-the-record Fortune. And that's actually becoming more valuable in many ways. Not more valuable than the on-the-record, but more valuable to this audience that we serve. They really crave an opportunity to talk across industry and to have conversations that are curated in a way that make them smarter.
Yeah, and I've often said in all business, you know, access matters, mm-hmm. and access of opinion matters. And so if all you're just doing is reading the headlines, these nuances can add a lot of value to the conversation. There are ways to report that without giving it up, so to speak.
Yeah, and look, I'm not the thought leader, and I think any time you see a journalist who is being the pundit or the thought leader, mm-hmm. I start to worry. It's like our job is to report and to recognize I'm not running one of the largest companies. I'm not investing people's money. My job is to really distill the essence of what matters, to get an opportunity to speak to people like you, and then to convey it to an audience that deeply cares about what's really going on. So that's, know my place. How about that?
No, I got you. But, you know, you talk about meeting so many of these CEOs and these leaders, even politically or not, you know, whatever the case may be.
Yeah, lots of leaders.
What do you think are some of the common traits that you see in successful business leaders? I mean, you have to say, aha. I mean, are there like four pillar points in your mind, or is there...
You're going back to my McKinsey, you know.
Yes.
Alliteration, five things, three
right,
points.
Right, right.
I think certainly curiosity. I think people who are genuinely curious about where the world's going, so that you ask that first question, the second question. I think the ability to make rapid decisions, which is not my strong suit. I mean, the world is gray, and of course, nothing's black and white, but that ability to really say, we're going to do this, have a North Star, set the strategy, the tone, the mission, and then go for it. I think that differentiates leaders. There's a certain being able to distill things down to a simplicity so you can drive it through the organization. But simplicity in a way that's right. It's very easy to be simplistic. I mean, we see plenty of examples of that around the world. But to understand the right direction and go for it, and to kind of ride it out through good times and bad because you have a vision. And then the other thing, frankly, is they usually have enough humility to have a great team around them. If they don't, that's how they tend to fail.
Media once shaped, you know, business narratives that were, you know,
when was that?
I don't know, it was like 1,000 years ago, you know, and now businesses often control the narrative themselves. you know,
they try to.
Right. So how do you combat that? How do you adjust for that? And, you know, where, you know, these CEOs now have their own media platforms.
Yeah, look,
and so how do you challenge that? At the same time, you said be a platform for CEOs. You know,
I don't challenge it. And I think every company, you know, can technically be a media company. Look, I can make a Hollywood quality movie on my iPhone. That does not make me Steven Spielberg. I'm not saying that that's the league we're in, because frankly, some of the best journalism comes from people who've never called themselves a journalist. So I think there's no license to do what I do. You're prove it every day in what you actually produce, and people, you know, stress testing it because it's so public. I mean, the nature of my job is everything I produce, everybody gets to see. And if I'm wrong, I will know it in about 35 seconds after it's published.
Failure is an interesting knife. It burns quickly.
Exactly. And look, I think that I'm curious about what companies produce also informs what I report. Some of the best reporters I've worked with over my career have been shut out of those companies and frankly have had better reporting than being let in. You know, the way that I remember the GE CEO Jack Welch used to say he could smell the fresh paint every time he went on a tour. Like, you know, there's access can be a Faustian pact sometimes. So I think the quality of your reporting is partly the quality of your access, but it's also the quality of the homework that you do, talking to enough people, understanding what a great story is, mm-hmm. knowing your audience. I mean, and then here we are doing a podcast. Live journalism is also something that, frankly, is hard to replicate. You'd think for decades now, companies have been able to be media companies, and yet there's still a role for earned media. There's still a role for somebody who's not in your employ to be asking you questions because it says something.
And I think society is still starving for integrity and authenticity. And it's getting harder. Yeah, and
right?
Intelligence,
I mean,
correct.
Nobody needs more content. Nobody needs more events. But they certainly need better versions of both.
Correct.
We value that.
I want to pivot just a little bit because you wrote a book back in 2012.
Yes.
The book Fraternity, which was actually recognized as Amazon's one of its bestsellers in 2012. And I just had a simple question. What inspired you to write that?
I was at lunch with one of the people in the book, Stan Grace, and he was the former deputy mayor of New York, and he was running a firm called MRB. It was the largest minority-owned investment bank on Wall Street. And it was the day that Ted Wells was in the newspaper representing Scooter Libby.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, so there you go. They're way all back. Right. And I said, he says, I went to school with Ted. And they're both black men, and I said, oh, that's interesting. He goes, yeah, and I went to school with Clarence Thomas, who many of you may listen to, may know. And then it was a guy who was in the Miami Dolphins, perfect season, Eddie Jenkins, a guy who'd won a Pulitzer, Edward P. Jones. They all lived in the same hall, and they happened to have been recruited by a guy named John Brooks to Holy Cross in Worcester, and John Brooks was still alive. And so that got me just down doing a magazine article. It did take me a year to get Clarence Thomas. He was not somebody who opens the door to the media. It was before his book.
And did it take time to get him to?
It took time. Once I got in, I got 3.5 hours. So, I mean,
correct.
But, you know, obviously people were extremely curious at that point as well about Justice Thomas, because he was not known as somebody who said a lot, if anything, on the bench. Mm-hmm. He had not written his own book. I mean, really, he was this enigma in the Supreme Court. And so even that interview alone caused a wave. And to be honest, Bruce, I was approached about writing a book. I would say writing a book is the hardest thing I've done, because I just, you know, I get to page 40. I'm like, I'm done. You
right.
know, I'm not sounding
and
like
you don't
like,
want to
I've
fill
got
it with just stuff.
140
right.
more pages. And I don't think that's my best self writing a book, but it was valuable. And I became very close to the people that I wrote about. So there's a bit of a pack,
too. So what you're saying is you wrote the book, you found a little something about yourself, but you also, what was the most exciting or the surprising discovery of your research during that book?
With that?
Was it Clarence Thomas?
I think Clarence Thomas. You know, Clarence Thomas has a great sense of humor. He was quite wistful about, he had, you know, obviously for probably political reasons and otherwise, there had been a separation from his classmates at that time, and it ended up bringing them back together. He came back to a reunion. He reconnected with Ted, because Ted was somebody who was, you know, he had been quite a prominent Democrat. He was the legal counsel for the NAACP, in addition to running the litigation practice at Paul Weiss, which has been in the news lately with the current administration. Yeah. So he was a young man who was very active in dealing with questions of racism, Martin Luther King. I mean, his life took a different trajectory. His time at Holy Cross, I think, was precious, and he valued it in a way he did not value his Yale.
So you found kind of a human side to his story, for lack of better
words. We're all
human
beings. Right. You know, I'm the daughter of a salesman and the daughter of a nurse. I think my dad gave me hustle and humor. My mother gave me the gift of thinking, nobody's more important than me, nobody's less important. And so that's, we just connect as human beings.
Right.
You know, there's.
And is that what you think is your, I think everyone has a superpower. And I think one of your superpowers is you have the ability, because I've seen you in many interviews of like, okay, how did she get that information? And how did she, not a gotcha moment, but just how, you know, and I've often wondered, you know, just in your own view, because I think you are curious as a person, what do you think, I didn't mean to just dive in with it, what do you think makes a compelling story? I mean, because as you're talking and asking, you have to be thinking to some degree that you're curious that others are thinking the same thing.
Well, I guess, look, I do think being genuinely curious and just treating somebody as a human being, not being intimidated by them, because, you know, just, what's to be intimidated? We all are in different jobs. We have all have different degrees of luck and skill. I don't think it makes us better than each other. It just makes us different. But I think what makes a great story is the elements of something you, A, it's useful, right? This is information I want to know. It's a fresh perspective. Somebody's position, right? If the head of, you know, the world's largest bank says something, that's probably more interesting if they're commenting on the markets than if it's just some random person that I meet on the street. Not always, but so the position you're in, if you have a lot of influence, that makes it interesting. But ultimately, what is a good story? We're sitting here talking. It's how do you connect as human beings? It's the drama. I mean, nothing is more dramatic. Everything is business, right? I mean, it's human emotion. It's change. It's spending money, you know, like fabulously badly or well. It's the personalities and how and why we make the decisions we do. I think we all know a good story when we see it, and you can't crowdsource it, right? You can't, it's like, it's almost like, you know, what's the hot color in socks this spring? Yeah, I don't know. You tell me, but right. You know a good story when you see it.
Do you think leadership is harder today and the stakes are different? And how do they triumph over these crises? And you know, what do you think some of those common traits are? Because I always say it's not how you fall, it's how you rise.
Yeah,
and
that's true.
In today's society, it seems as though they're ill-tolerant to any fall. And yet I think the rise is so much more interesting.
A redemption
right.
story. I think it's harder to portray a certain image and have it remain intact. Like the idea of like whether you're an elder statesman or you could, you know, your team could put out an image. Because there's just too many people around you. Like if you... we're too transparent a world, and I think there's too much of a demand to be a human being. I mean, let's face it, you've got Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg. We tend to look at them as human beings. Nobody's held up as a great leader that's just kind of beyond reproach. So that's the starting point, is there are plenty of people with plenty of opinions about you and plenty of data points for whatever you're trying to project. You have to walk the walk. You can't have your communications team sort of put out
and I think,
is who I am.
And I think Martha Stewart was a perfect example of that.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, I mean, she rocks, okay? And the reason why she rocks is because I remember the Martha Stewart, you know, pre-Wall Street issues.
Martha Stewart Omnimedia.
Yeah, and then post, and then her recovery, and where she's at today. I mean, she's just outright cool.
But it wasn't easy.
You
think about that. I mean,
but
she,
you come to appreciate the struggle. And she shrugs it off like, yeah.
I mean, you know, to some extent, what choice do you have, right? But
no,
I think you're absolutely right. But boy, this was a billion-dollar brand that went public actually the same day as World Wrestling Entertainment, interestingly enough. And then she ended up being sent to jail. In my opinion, it was the government kind of taking a baseball bat to some. I mean, she basically was standing on the tarmac. It was ImClone Sam Waxel, and it was an insider trading situation where her broker said sell and she sold. And what she ended up going to jail for was really the cover up was worse than the crime. And so that really did destroy her brand. She had to rebuild. And here she is. You have to give her credit. She's on the cover of, you know,
she's cool.
Sports Illustrated.
She's cool.
Got Snoop Dogg. But right. She's fundamentally a different brand.
And I think she would actually say that she's now unconstrained with that brand because she's lived through a lot of those experiences. You know her.
We
I don't.
We should bring her on and ask her. I would suspect that there's a bit of wistfulness about the opportunities denied. You know, and
correct.
And I think you're right. That ability to accept what's been handed to you, because what choice do we have? Life hands all of us things we'd rather not have
right.
at times that we'd rather not have those handed to us. And you have two choices. You either cope and say, okay, this is what I have and get on with it. And it's a new day. It's a mindset. Or you just let it fail you. And of course, there's many other things in between, but those are the choices we all have.
See, I think that's where your job becomes cool too, because you get to kind of move in and out of these streams.
And in a way, I guess one thing I think I'm a bit different than when I was younger is I love great stories. I used to love doing what was in the journal called the A-head. I was the A-head queen, these quirky stories of people and, you know, fascinating little character studies. I think not that I'm kinder, but you start to realize that there are some details that deserve to stay private. Let's put it that mm-hmm. way. And then also contextually, in certain cultures, having what would be an innocuous quote in the U.S. could get somebody fired in, say, Singapore or China. And to understand that what comes out has consequence for the people you write about, and to treat people with dignity. You know, even as you're writing the truth, like, people should not be surprised by what they read. They should know before anybody else.
I'm going to pivot a little bit because you've seen some wars. You've also seen some great things.
I hung out with Hezbollah. Can you imagine this? And I was just out of college and I stayed a week in Kashmir with Hezbollah. You can't do that now. I would just be fodder.
I was going
to
ask you another question, but kind of dive into that.
But that's like the world's changed. So there you go.
But listen, I just want to let you know that I really appreciate you taking out the time. I was really looking forward to this because
me too.
I think journalism is right now at this moment in time losing to headlines. And so we need champions in the world of news and gathering that information. And I think an individual like yourself showing, first of all, empathy and integrity and the authenticity of that information needs to be heard more and more. So really
Thank
appreciate
you.
Taking the time out.
Yeah, I enjoy it. And I'm going to see you at one of our events.
That's correct.
Soon. So thank you these are conversations to be continued.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Changing the game, shattering expectations, rewriting the rules. Meet the new visionaries, the rebels, the ones who dare to disrupt.
When you're on a show like this, we're always talking about disruption.
The way that this is transforming is people want an actual connection with the person that they're listening to.
Exploring the industries revolutionizing our world. The Disruptors. From the Fountain Blue Las Vegas Resort.